Mr. Zawasu Peg Yun Mishnah Zain, Tum Sech Sanhedrin Peg Aleph Mishnah Beis. Shnei Achim, if there are two brothers whose father died and they both inherit their father, and Echad Oni, one of the brothers is poor, the Echad Osher, and one of them is wealthy. And part of the inheritance which their father left them was V'hiniach Lohen Avien Merchotz V'Sabad. Their father left behind a bathhouse and an olive press to press olives and create oil. Now, of course, the poor person cannot really use an olive press very much. He hasn't got enough money to buy olives and squeeze them into oil. And the bathhouse as well, he can use it. But he's not somebody who has lots of slaves, who he can use this bathhouse for the slaves to wash there as well. So for him, it would be a much bigger advantage to perhaps rent out the bathhouse or the olive press, or to sell it for money. But since they both inherited this together, and it's not really something which can be split, what can be done? Says the Mishnah, son, Sochar, if the father originally made the bathhouse or the olive press in order to rent it out to others, then Hasochar lo'emtza, the rent would go to the middle, meaning they can actually use it to rent it out. The poor person can force the wealthy person to rent it out, and they would share the rent which comes in. Ason la'atzmon, if the father originally made the bathhouse or the olive press for his own use, not in order to rent it out, so once the brothers inherit it, now the wealthy person can turn around to the poor person and tell him that whatever our father made it for, that's how it's going to continue to be used. Hariya osha emila oni, the wealthy person can now turn around and say to the poor person, kach lo havodim, buy for yourself slaves, v'yirchatz v'amerchatz, and they will wash themselves in the bathhouse. Kach lo zesim, buy for yourself olives, uvoy v'asim v'esabad, and come make them, process them in the olive press. Of course, the poor person hasn't got enough money to buy these things, but the point is that the wealthy person can maintain that for himself, and since theoretically speaking, it is now designated for both of their uses, the poor person cannot force the wealthy person, the wealthy brother, to rent it out, because it's designated for their use, that's what the father made it for. Next part of the Mishnah. Shnayim shayu be'ir achas, if there are two people who live in the same city, in the same town, Shem Echad Yosef ben Shimon, the name of the first person is called Yosef, the son of Shimon, V'shem Acher, and the name of the other person is also Yosef ben Shimon, and he's the son of Shimon. Ein yachayim l'hoitzi shtar chayv zal zeh, they are not able to take out a shtar chayv, a document which records a loan, against the other one, meaning if one of them lent money to the other one, they're not able to claim that money back. Because the other person can claim that actually he's the one who lent him money. He didn't borrow money, and all that is written on a regular document is just the name of the borrower and lender, their father's name, and the name of their city. But here it's all identical. And as well as that, nobody else is able to claim money from either of them based on a shtar chayv, a document which records the loan, because he can always claim that it's not me who borrowed the money, it's the other Yosef ben Shimon who borrowed the money. Go claim the money off him. And the lender has no proof otherwise. In addition to that, nimtzal echa ben shtarisov, if somebody finds among his documents a document which says, a receipt which says, shtar shal Yosef ben Shimon parua, the loan document of Yosef ben Shimon has been paid. Meaning we're discussing another person who borrowed money from both Yosef ben Shimons, and he has a receipt saying that he already paid back one of the Yosef ben Shimons. Says the Mishnah, Shtori Shneim Peruin, we consider both of their loans, their loan documents, to have been collected already, and neither of them would be able to claim money from this other person, because he can take out his document and he says, look, I've got a document which says that I repaid my loan to Yosef ben Shimon. So of course this is a very problematic situation, and the Mishnah asks, Ketzad Yasu, how should they go about things? Is there not a way to solve this problem? Answers the Mishnah very simply, yes, Yishaleishu. They should triple their names. Meaning, even though in general, on the document is written the person's name and his father's name, over here they should say Yosef ben Shimon, and then the son of his grandfather. Says the Mishnah, V'moyim Mishuloshin, what happens if the grandfather's name was also the same? Then Yichtavu Simon, they should write on the document a certain distinguishing feature about this particular person, which makes him different to the other person. They should say Yosef ben Shimon ben Yaakov, the one who has black hair. Something like that, so that they can distinguish between the two Yosef ben Shimons. But what happens in Moim Sumonim, if they both had very similar features, and they can't really clearly identify one of them being different to the other, then Yichtavu Koyein. they should write on the document that he's a Kohen, if he's a Kohen and the other one is not a Kohen. And what happens if they're both Kohanim? So then the Gemara explains that they should write the grandfather and the great-grandfather until you get to a point where they don't have exactly the same ancestry. Alright, next part of the Mishnah. Ha'irei Levnoi, one who says to his son, just before he is about to die, that I lent money to a number of different people, and they all owe me money, but shtar ben shtaroset parua. One of the documents which I have has already been repaid, so when I die, don't try claim money from that person again. But the problem is, ve'eni de ezehu. I don't actually know, and I can't remember who was the borrower who has already paid back his loan. Says the Mishnah, Shtoris Kulon Peruin, the documents of all of them are considered to be repaid, and the son would not be able to reclaim any of those loans, because it would always be a doubt as to whether this borrower has already repaid. So out of doubt, he's not able to reclaim that loan. Now what happens if one of the borrowers borrowed from this person twice? Now, the person said that one of the loans has been repaid. So he's definitely owed some money from this person, even if he is the borrower who repaid the loan. He didn't repay both of the loans. The father said that only one of the loans has been repaid. So the Mishnah says, if one of the borrowers has two documents saying that he borrowed from this person who has now died, then Hagolo Parua, the larger document is considered to be, the larger loan is considered to be repaid, meaning the son of the person who died is only able to reclaim, to take the loan, which is smaller. He's at least owed that amount. Any more than that is already a doubt, and therefore he's not got the power to claim that. The smaller loan would not be considered repaid, and he can claim at least the smaller amount. Now the remaining Mishnah and a half discusses an Orev. An Orev is a guarantor. If, for example, Reuven borrows money from Shimon, but perhaps Shimon is not willing to lend Reuven the money unless there's somebody else who promises to pay back in the case where Reuven is not able to pay back. So that third person would be called an Orev. He's a guarantor. And the Mishnah says, Hamalves chaver alide Orev, one who lends money to somebody else, Shimon lends money to Reuven through an Orev, meaning there is another guarantor, we'll call him Shimon. The law is that Loyapar an Orev. Shimon is not able to collect the loan from the Orev. And the Gemara explains that the intent of the Mishnah is to say that unless Shimon first takes Reuven to Beis Din, and Beis Din investigate, and they find that Reuven really does not have enough money to pay back, only then would the guarantor then become obligated to pay back the loans instead of Reuven the borrower. V'im Omar, and if the lender Shimon originally said at the time of the loan that I'm lending you the money, on condition that I'm able to collect the loan from whichever of you two who I choose, either from you, Reuven, the borrower, or from Levi, the guarantor. Says the Mishnah, in this case, Shimon is able to collect the loan from the guarantor instead of Reuven. And the Gemara explains, even in this case, if Reuven has possessions, he has money to give back, then he's not able to collect it from the guarantor. He can only take it from Reuven. The point is, though, that we don't need to take Reuven to Beis Din. If it's known that Reuven doesn't have any money, then he's able to go to the guarantor and collect it from him, even without proving it in Beis Din. However, if Reuven does have money, then Shimon is not able to collect it from the guarantor. He can only collect it from Reuven the borrower himself. Now, until now, we've been discussing a regular Orev. There is another type of Orev called an Orev Kablon, and according to this opinion in the Mishnah, although it's not stated explicitly, but according to the Tanakhama, there's such a thing as an Orev Kablon where the guarantor accepts upon himself to repay the loan, even in a case where Reuven has money. The deal is that the lender is able to collect it from either one of them, even in a case of Reuven has money, if that is the deal which they accept upon themselves. However, Shimon Gamliel says, if the borrower has possessions, he has the money and the ability to repay the loan, then benkach uvenkach, whether in the case of a regular Orev, or even in the case of an Orev Kablan, lo yiparmin Orev. He cannot collect money from the guarantor, and there's really no such thing as an Orev Kablan. As long as the borrower himself is able to pay back, the lender is never able to collect the debt from anybody else except for the borrower. So we see that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel is more lenient on the guarantor, on the Orev. The Chain Horeb Shimon Gamliel Omer, and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, in another case, was also more lenient, or he set a unique law for the benefit of the guarantor. Horeb Lo Ishel Bichsubosa, one who is a guarantor for a woman for her kasuba. Somebody was going to get married to a woman, and he becomes obligated to give her a certain amount of money, that's part of the kasuba, And another person accepted upon himself that I'm going to guarantee the kasuba for you, the woman. If the husband doesn't end up being able to pay, I'll pay it instead of him. And then, after a while, the husband decided to divorce his wife. When he divorces her, she becomes entitled to collect her kasuba. And it happened in this case that the husband who was doing the divorce does not have enough money to pay the kasuba. And so the Oriv is going to need to do that. Says the Mishnah, Yadireno Hana'a, the man who is divorcing her needs to make a neder, a vow that he's not going to have any benefit from that woman, which means that he won't be able to remarry her. And the reason why he needs to do this is because we're concerned, Shemayasu Kanunya and the Chosim Shalzeh, in case the husband and wife will do a scheme against the guarantor's possessions, Vyasras Ishtahi, and then remarry his wife. They know that if he divorces his wife now, then he'll have to pay her the money of the kasuba. And then he'll just remarry her and they'll have an extra 200 zuz or whatever the amount of the kasuba is for them to keep. So in order to make sure that is not the case, and they don't just have this scheme and then they're going to remarry, the husband needs to divorce his wife and make a neder, a vow that he's not going to benefit from her and he's not able to remarry her. And in such case, certainly they won't be scheming. Rather, he genuinely wants to divorce her. And in that case, the Orev will indeed need to pay the kasuba because that is what he accepted upon himself. Mishnah Ches, the law is that when a man lends somebody else money, let's say Reuven lends Shimon money, if Shimon is not able to repay the loan when the date arrives, then Reuven is able to collect that debt from Reuven's property, from his land. In addition to that, even if Shimon sold the land, as long as he owned that piece of land at the time that he borrowed the money, Reuven would be able to collect that land even from those people who bought the land from him. This is known as Achrayis Nechosim, or Shibud Nechosim. That the lender has some sort of hold on all of the possessions, or the land at least, the real estate of the borrower. However, Midrabbanon, at least according to the conclusion of the Gemara, Midrabbanon, a loan which was made without witnesses, the law of Achrayis Nechosim does not apply to such a loan. Reason being that such a loan doesn't become very well known, which means that when somebody in general, if somebody's buying a field, so he investigates whether the person who is selling him the field borrowed money from somebody else, in which case there would be a danger that the field's going to be snatched away from him. But if the loan was made in private and there weren't witnesses about it, so this loan doesn't become well known, and there's no way that the buyers can really protect themselves from the danger of the field being snatched away from them. It's true that, of course, the person who sold it to them would need to compensate them with money, but, of course, they don't want that to happen. They want to buy the field and keep the field for themselves. And because of that, if the loan was made without witnesses, and it's not well known, in order to protect, as it were, the buyers of fields, to protect their rights, the law of Achrayis Nechosim Midrabbanon will not apply to such a loan. So it begins the Mishnah, Mavis Chaver Bishtar, one who lends money to somebody else. Reuven lends money to Shimon with a document. Now in general, inside the document, they would write this idea of Achrayis Nechosim, that in a case where the borrower is not able to pay back, the lender will be able to collect from his property, even once it's been sold on. But the Mishnah is telling us that even if it wasn't written inside the document, we assume that that was a mistake of the scribe, not that they made an agreement between each other there wouldn't be Achrayis Nechosim, and therefore even in this case, Gevim Nechosim Shubadim, the lender would be able to collect the debt from property which has already been sold on, because the law of Achrayis Nechosim applies even if it's not explicitly written inside of the document. As long as there are witnesses who signed on the document, Aidei Eidim, the truth is the Mishnah says even more than I said, if the loan is made in front of witnesses, but they didn't write it down, even in that case, Gevim Nechosim Nechayrin, the lender would only be able to collect from property which is free, meaning which has not been sold on. Because even when there are witnesses, if it's not written inside of a document, then it is less well known, and the buyers haven't really got a way of protecting themselves from this danger. What happens if Haitzel Ksav Yodai, if a lender brings out a document to a borrower, and the document is a document where the borrower wrote on the document that he borrowed money from this person and he owes him the money. Since there are no witnesses who signed on there, Shu Chayev Loi, on the document which says that the borrower owes money to the lender, again, since there are no witnesses, Gevim Nechosim Nechayrin, he would only be able to collect from property which is free and has not been sold on. And now the Mishnah goes back to the laws of an Orev, a guarantor. And in general, the guarantor accepts upon himself to be an Orev, before the loan is completed. That's really part of the idea, that the lender is not willing to make the loan to give him money unless there is an orev, so that he's guaranteed to receive payment. But what about an orev, an orev who accepted upon himself to be an orev after the loan document was already signed and completed? He added on onto the document that he's an orev on the loan. So that means that no witnesses signed on this part, because he wrote this down after the witness has already signed. And therefore, at least with regards to the orev, he would have the law of somebody who lent money without witnesses. And therefore, given Chazmin Chayrin, if they are collecting money from the guarantor, they can only collect it from property which he has not sold on. Such a story, such a case came in front of Rabbi Yishmael, the Omar, and he ruled, like the Mishnah said, that he can only collect from property which has not been sold on. Bananas says to Rabbi Yishmael, he can't collect, not only can he not collect from property which has been sold on, he can't collect from any property which the guarantor still owns. Because according to Bananas, he's not considered an orev at all. Omar Loi, Rabbi Shmuel said to Bananas, Lomo, why is that? Omar Loi, Bananas said to him, I'll give you a moshel, a parable. Harechonigas echad bashuk. If somebody is strangling somebody in the marketplace, this is not literal, but somebody is forcing another person who borrowed money from him to repay the loan. And Mitzoy Chaveiroi, his friend found him over there, Omar Loi, and he said to the lender, Hanach Loi, leave him alone, and I'll give you the money which he owes you. Says Mishnah, Potter. In such a case, certainly he'll be exempt and he won't have the law of an orev. This happened way after the loan was made. So he's not considered an orev because Shalayah Menosailvo. The lender didn't make the loan based on his belief and reliance on this orev. Ela Ezo Orev Shulchayev. What is the concept of an orev who is obligated to pay in a case where the borrower can't pay? That's only if Halveyu Va'ani Noisin Loch. If this orev says to the lender before he's made the loan, lend him money and I'll give you back the money in a case where he can't pay. The whole idea of an orev, according to Bananas, is that Chayv he'll be liable, Shekinam el Menosa Ilvo, that he lent him the money based on his reliance on this orev. Only then would the orev actually be obligated to indeed pay the money if need be. But otherwise, once the loan has been made, it's impossible to become an orev after that. Omer Rabbi Shmuel said, he exclaimed, Haroitz Sheyachkim, one who wants to become wise, Yasub Dinim Omnes, he should involve himself in monetary law. This, we were coming to the end of Maseches Bava Kama Bava Metzia Bava Basra, which originally were one large Masechta of 30 parakim, discussing all sorts of monetary law, damages, stealing, fraud, neighbors, partnerships, etc., what we've seen over the last three Masechtas. And Rabbi Shmuel is saying, one who wants to become wise should learn these three Masechtas. She'in loch mikzor b'atera golo mehen. Because you have no subject, you have no area in Torah which is as great as them. She'in kamayon ha'neveya. They are like a spring which overflows, and the amount of logic and how much the human mind can connect to the Torah and delve deep, deep into the Torah's logic that is present the most in these two Masechtas. And Rabbi Shmuel added, V'areitzash Yazav Dinim Omnes, one who wants to involve himself in monetary law, Yishamishes Shimon Benanos, he should serve and watch and take Shimon Benanos as an example, because he is the expert in this area of Torah. Solik Maseches Bava Basra, Mazel Tov. We begin Maseches Sanhedrin, and Maseches Sanhedrin contains within it 11 parakim, which discuss how the Beis Din, the Jewish court, worked. And there are really three categories, three different types of Beis Din, depending on what case is being judged. And really the entire first perek talks about how many judges, which type of Beis Din is necessary for which cases. The smallest Beis Din is a Beis Din of three judges, three dayanim. And that's really any monetary law, and the Mishnah will give many examples, not just monetary law. And the vast majority of cases which are brought to Beis Din require a Beis Din of three judges. The second type of Beis Din is called the Sanhedrin Ketana, and that consists of 23 judges. And they would judge cases which involve a capital offense, something for which there is a death penalty involved. And there's actually a mitzvah for every city in Eretz Yisrael to have their own Sanhedrin Ketana. And then thirdly, there is the Sanhedrin Agdoila, the main Beis Din of 71 judges. There was only one of these, and they actually sat in the Beis HaMikdash itself. That is where they would judge certain cases, which this perek will list. And the perek begins with the smallest beis din, which cases require only three judges, three dayonim. Dini momnus, monetary matters, b'shaloshah require three judges. Gzelos, cases involve stealing, v'chavolos, or when somebody injures another person and is liable to pay him, b'shaloshah that requires three judges. Now, why does the Mishnah split them up into two groups? The Gemara explains that the first case we're talking about is not just any monetary law, it's talking about laws involving loans. Now, it's learned from Psukim, where the Torah uses the word Elohim, referring to the judges, the Dayonim, and it uses that word three times, and we learn from there that monetary law requires a beis din of three expert judges. A real Dayonim. Now, Majabonon, they were lenient in a case of loans, that you don't need three expert Dayonim, rather it's enough that you have three regular people. They can judge a case of a loan. The reason being, in order to encourage people to lend money, and they made it easier to claim that money, it's easier to set up the beis din for the lender to claim that money from the borrower. And that's why the Mishnah splits it into two different groups, because when we're talking about loans, you only need three regular people. Whereas with regards to other monetary law, like stealing and damages and injuring people, that requires three expert dayonim, as learnt from the Pesukim. Nezek, if somebody damages another person's property, or if somebody's animal damages, so he's liable to pay for the full damages, v'chatzi nezek, or cases where one is liable to pay only for half of the damages, there are certain cases like that discussed in Bava Kamma, tashlumei kefel, the punishment of a thief, then he needs to pay back double, he needs to pay back the item plus its value, v'tashlumei abba v'chamisha, this refers to a thief. If a thief steals a sheep or an ox and then slaughters it or sells it, the Torah has a unique fine that he needs to pay back four or five times the value. Not just double, but four or five times the value, depending on whether it's a sheep or an ox. Be as it may, all of these monetary laws, b'shlosha, require a beis din of three expert dayonim. Ha'ones, one who forces a woman to have relations with him. Ramafate, or one who seduces and convinces a woman to have relations with him. The Torah gives fines for somebody who does this. Vahamitzi Shemra, one who marries a woman and claims that when he had relations with her, he discovered that she had actually had relations beforehand. If he is discovered to have made this up, then he is liable to pay a fine. So again, this is considered a monetary matter, and therefore b'shlosha requires three dayonim. Dear Rav Meir, that is the opinion of Rav Meir, but the Chachom say, Motzi Shemra, regarding a man who comes to Beis Din claiming that the woman who he married, who he assumed had not yet had relations before, had relations, but Esma Shalosha, that requires a Beis Din of 23 judges, a Sanhedrin Ketana. Is because it could end up as a capital offense. If it is discovered that the woman, after she received kiddushin, which is the first stage of marriage, she had relations with another man before the marriage was completed with the person who she received kiddushin from, the punishment for having relations with another man after she already received kiddushin from this man is a death penalty. And so the claim which this man is making against her could end up as a capital offense on the woman, and therefore it needs to be begun already from the beginning with a beis din of 23 judges. Mishnah beis, makos, a beis din which is judging a case of somebody who is liable to malchus, to lashes. This punishment applies to most prohibitions. B'shloshah, that requires three judges. It's not a capital offense, so it's enough to have just three dayonim. Mishum Rabbi Shmuel Omru. However, they said in the name of Rabbi Shmuel, be'esem shloshah, that you actually require 23 judges. The Gemara gives two reasons for this. We'll mention one of them, that the punishment of lashes is really supposed to be in place of death. Whenever somebody does any avera, they really deserve to die. They went against Hashem. But Hashem put into the Torah that you can receive the punishment of Malchus, and via that, receive an atonement instead of being killed. But since it's in place of being killed, it requires 23 judges. Now, in the times of the Mishnah, there was not a fixed calendar, and every month was either 29 or 30 days, and the beis din would need to decide, based on hearing the testimony of witnesses, that they saw the moon, as it is supposed to appear at the beginning of a month. And if they accepted the testimony of the witnesses, then the beis din would declare the 30th day of the month to actually be the first day of the next month to be Rosh Chodesh. So how many judges are required for that? It says Mishnah Ibra Chodesh, to decide how long the month is going to be, B'shloisha, that requires three dayonim. Ibra Hashana, when the beis din are deciding whether to add on a Adar Sheni, to make it a leap year, again that would require B'shloisha, three dayonim. That is the opinion of Rav Meir. Rav Moshe ben Gamliel. Rav Moshe ben Gamliel says, "B'shalosh maschilin." They start with three judges, and if the majority think that it is worthwhile to add on a month to make it into a leap year, then uvachamish aloisim v'noisin, they would add on another two judges and discuss this with five judges. And if the majority of them think that they should make it into a leap year, then they would add on another two judges, v'goyim b'shiva. And they would reach the end decision with seven dayanim, as long as the majority of them think that it should be made into a leap year, and then they will declare the leap year. And the Gemara explains that even though really three judges should be enough, as the Mishnah now adds, v'imgomu b'shleisha, if they did reach an end decision and they made the verdict with only three judges, mu'beres, the year does become a leap year. However, ideally it should be done in this way by adding on another two and then another two judges in order to parallel Birkas Kohanim. The bracha given by the Kohanim, the first pasuk has three words, the next one has five words, and the final pasuk has seven words. So in order to bring in this bracha as they are making it into a leap year, ideally this is the way that it should be done. But strictly speaking, in terms of the basin, really a basin of three judges is sufficient, even according to Rav Moshe ben Gamliel.